Hello and welcome to episode 20 of the Poolside Pass podcast. This is the series finale for series one. And in today's episode, I speak to David Marsh, head coach at the University of San Diego and Team Elite. David's also been historically head coach at Auburn University, Swimmat Carolina. He was actually the most successful coach at Auburn University history, regardless of sport. And has been the head coach of the US Olympic team as well back in 2016. I speak to David about his experiences coaching and what he holds close to his heart in terms of his philosophies as a coach. Before we get into the episode, just a big thank you to our listeners who have listened throughout series one. We've had, I think, over 2,000 streams now across all 20 episodes, so I'm really pleased with that. Just a quick line now from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real-time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. So, David Marsh, before I jump into talking about the titles you won at Auburn, I'll probably just start by talking about kind of, I've seen on your website, like you're a technique first coach. So just kind of talking about that to start with, and then we can go into the rest of the content.
Yeah, so I think I just discovered through my career in terms of where the highest value was as far as improving and having people enjoy the sport the most and was the most appealing to sort of my personality, which I'm sort of a creative kind of coach that likes to see movement patterns and things like that. And so my whole career, I've sort of been, I guess, more of a technical coach first before I considered training that technique. And really one of my big goals was to not have the training rip apart the technique to the point where you would lose the benefits of great technique by overloading the training systems too much to where you couldn't swim proper technique. It doesn't mean once in a while I don't do it, but within my philosophy, I think that's really my foundation belief is to build up to great technical swimming and then train that technical swimming, maybe push it over the edge occasionally, but come right back to it and really own fabulous technique. And it's been I've done it at all levels. So I've done, you know, club, high school, college, professionals. So the formula does work, and especially it works for young kids. I mean, young kids, it's life and death because, you know, learning the proper technique early will set a trajectory that will allow them to reach the highest level, or by, you know, having giant elbow drops or, you know, scrambling with high turnover rates at a young age, especially at the, you know, 13, 14, 15 age. There's not a whole lot you can do with that in terms of developing most athletes into something special if they're already swimming like that at a young age. So it's you know, and all the while I'm learning as well. So there, you know, I have really, you know, excellent people around me. Podcasts like yours, I think, creates new thought and new ideas, and I love hearing and sharing about those things. So I by no means have everything figured out. I'm still learning as I go. But I have tried a lot of things and I've failed at a lot of things, and that's made me more wise.
So you say you've done it, that you kind of use that philosophy of technique first kind of at all different levels. How do you strike the balance between, especially with kind of swimmers that are starting to get further on through their development, how do you strike that balance between the technical stuff, but also then needing to have to get some work involved as well?
Yeah, I think as an athlete gets older, obviously they've swum with that sort of that neuromuscular patterning for a longer period of time. So it's more locked in than it would be. I would say, especially in the Olympic year like this, and when you're about a year out, I might take a swimmer who looks like their trajectory isn't going to get them to the Olympic team in the USA or to their Olympic team on their international team or to the Olympic medal stand, if that's their true goal and ambition. And with some of those guys, I'll take big risk. I'll say, okay, let's make the big risk instead of, you know, sometimes it's, you know, let's go heavier into weightlifting and get you significantly stronger, or let's go heavier into volume so that your confidence in the last quarter of your race is higher than ever. But a lot of times it's let's take a big risk and really change your stroke pretty, in some cases, pretty radically. And every now and then that's even worked out with older, 25 to 30 year old athletes. A good example is during this coronavirus, we've been forced to use a small backyard pool. That's a nice 22 yard pool, but I train two people at a time in there. And it's the first time that I've trained in that small of environment in sort of a very quiet, quaint setting. And I found myself picking up not only the concentration of watching less swimmers and seeing everything they're doing, but also the sounds. So Dylan Carter is a good example. He's from Trinidad and Tobago, and he's a guy that could make finals at the Olympics if he put things together really well. He was in semifinals at Worlds last year. But by being in a pool where there wasn't many people around, I was listening to him swim, and I'm like, Dylan, you're making way too much noise, brother. Compared to guys that are your level and higher that are training in the same pool, you're the most noisy of everyone. So we've actually worked during this window of time while we've been under quarantine with having him swim a little bit more quietly. So just entering, instead of just smashing the water like his effective short course yards, swimming a little more elegance, a little more rhythm, a little more flow to the stroke. And so even when he's warming up, he really has to do the proper quiet stroke. And then we add a little bit of speed to it, but we're not doing anything at sustained race speed. We'll do some stuff really hard just to challenge their emotional side of them, because they do need to push. But when he's swimming, generally he's swimming more quietly than he used to. I believe it's going to make him a better freestyler, maybe a better butterflyer. But in any event, for right now, it's given him a project, and it's been fun for me to sort of teach from my ear rather than my eyes. And so that's been a new little twist.
I never thought of swimming quietly before. I've always thought about, less splash generally means it's better, but I've never thought about less noise generally means it's better. So that's an interesting one from my perspective, just to kind of think about that and reflect on that. So thank you.
You know, when I was a coach about your age, you're a young guy. I'll make a confession here at this stage of my career. I was coaching a team called the Dynamo Swim Club back in Atlanta. It was a big, very successful club, and I had a really amazing group of 14 to 16 year olds. And I would come in for morning practice at 4:15 in the morning, and then we'd start at 5 a.m. And there would be times when the night before I might have been out a little too late as a young, single, mid-20-something guy in Atlanta, Georgia, and would arrive to where I really didn't want to hear a lot of noise. So we'd actually do full sets where the swimmers' jobs were to, for example, kick with no white water at all. They have to kick underwater, so it's quiet kicking, and then swimming quietly too. I think they thought it was a technical thing, but it wasn't so much a technical thing. It's really just so I could get through that practice and get home and take a nap. So I think sometimes out of necessity, things are invented. And so I have actually used that out through my career, because I did find that when they're having to be more attentive to how they're managing their entries into the water, it actually caused them to concentrate a little bit more. And it was a bit of a challenge for a young swimmer. So there you go.
So just kind of fast forward and now to when you worked at Auburn, you won 12 NCAA titles there. How did you kind of instill this winning culture? Because you seemed to win more years than you didn't win. So how did you instill that kind of winning culture?
Well, it was so many things go into winning a team championship at the collegiate level that's hard to put my finger on one thing. And I would say the biggest thing I thought was that I had a very clear mission that I was on. And I was on a mission to where, because that was the school I went to, we had really good teams when I was when I was swam there, and we were always top 10 at NCAAs. We had world-class swimmers on our team at that time. And we had a lot of pride in our program. We didn't win any championships. We almost won SECs one year, but we didn't win any championships, but we fought hard at every meet we went to, and we thought we could win everything we went to. So we had that attitude. Well, that had eroded into the late 80s, and I saw that erosion happening. I was coaching in Las Vegas at the time, working with Las Vegas Gold Swim Team, and that's the window of time I was, Mel Stewart had moved out to train with me, and I had a few very good swimmers that were training with me out there. So I had a vision of swimming from a high level, but also from a club level in terms of what it takes to attract a high school kid into a college team. And Auburn wasn't that at that point. It wasn't a place where you'd go to make maximum improvement. And most eager young swimmers, their biggest goal is the Olympic Games, even if they, you know, it's a long shot. So when I took over at Auburn in 90, and I was about 30 years old, I was sort of like just a little pissed off at what the situation was, what the team had devolved to. So I sort of went in raging. I went in like, look, we're going to fix this. We're going to fix it right now. And I hope, and then even though you may not have chose to come to Auburn for these kinds of reasons, we're going to get this right, and it's going to get right immediately. And so in that era in the 90s, you could be, you know, I would say much more aggressive than you can now. There wasn't as much, there weren't as many layers of administrators and counselors and people like that, that sort of the athletes would have the first contact with before they have contact with the coach. Back those days, the coach was the primary contact for the athletic department. And so I sort of just reset the program for him and said, look, we're going to be a top 10 program again. And we even cast a vision the first year that by 1994, we would be SEC champions. And this was in 1990 when I went to NCAAs my first year with one female. She happened to just get disqualified in her only event in the meet. And then the men's team had no qualifiers at NCAAs before the year before I got there. So we had to really start in many ways from scratch. And we didn't have much of a pool. We had a 25-yard pool where there's sort of asbestos stuff dropping on us during practice. We had a new pool projected, so we did have hope for the future, but we started in sort of a – so we sort of took that in and said, look, the first few years is about just making it better for the longer-term future. And fortunately, we had a team buy into that. We had a Zoom call with that 90 to 94 era guys, and it was really fun seeing everybody again. That's one of the great things about this quarantine is we're getting to sort of catch up through Zoom with people we hadn't seen in years and years and years. And I think for the most part, they were all very grateful for a lot of lessons they had learned. I felt like I needed to apologize to them because I went in with just both guns a-blazing and just knowing that we were going to make a major change. I'm sure I wasn't always the most sensitive and caring coach. And I probably if I could do it again, I probably have done a little bit different. But the reality was the culture at first was shifted by a mandate. I just put a mandate down. This is the way it's going to be. And if you want to be on this team, if you want to be on my team, this is the way you're going to think. This is the way you're going to do things. And then over a few years, it became the pride started coming back. So we started competing better. We started getting better recruits. And so I think that it became more energized by the actual people on the team. So that was the next sort of step in the evolution of the program. The next step was actually, I continued to bring in excellent assistant coaches, and a lot of the coaches, at least in the U.S. and some around the world that you might know of, or some of the coaches that came through the program and went on to great careers, but they started being the key element in the team. So that by then the team was getting big and faster. So I would divide out the team quite a bit more, and the coaches would be involved a lot more in taking a group, knowing they had a group and running the group. Hired a fantastic female assistant coach, Kim Bracken at the time, Kim McDonald at the time, Kim Bracken now. And she sort of was focused on the women's team. And then later Dorsey Tierney Walker, who's doing a great job at Ohio State right now. She was the one that followed her, the female that followed her, to sort of be the leader of the women's team and be sort of my partner in building that program. So that went up a little bit at a time. The final evolution of the program was really when the athletes really took it. The athletes, so it went from being led by me to sort of being led by sort of positive momentum to being, I think, the coaches, a whole nother level of assistant coaches a lot more of the reasons we were winning, to eventually the standard was set to where before the athletes even would have somebody sign at our school, they would say, yeah, this person's going to be a contributor, but this person's not going to be a contributor, just to some degree by their personality, sometimes by how fast they were. So we would certainly make some exceptions if they're fast enough. We'd have to go, okay, we have to work with this person, even if they're have a little bit of different personality. And so we would take some chances that way. But the athletes had a whole lot more to say so in the end. In fact, you know, last year when I coached college in 2007, we both won both the men's and the women's titles. I really, you know, by then I was really just managing the team and managing the championships. So if something needed to be done, you know, I would dive into, you know, in January, let's say I'd take five or six of the key swimmers that needed to score a lot of points, and I just take them myself and I say, okay, I got these guys through NCAAs and we're going to get them fast. And then I would do a lot of the, you know, compete or let's say negotiating with the athletic department, promoting our program, you know, in the town and community and throughout the country so our brand would grow. So those are things I would spend a lot, if not majority of my time on at that point. And so it's a great question because the culture evolved over time. It didn't stay the same.
Yeah.
But it was always a culture that had some element of exclusivity to it. It wasn't like everybody's invited. There were definitely super fast people that we would have on a visit and say, yeah, you're not one of our kind of people. You know, Auburn's in a, you know, rural town in Alabama, and it not everybody's going to fit that vibe there.
Yeah.
And we had to have the right kind of people to plug into the team. And internationals were a key part of that. I mean, when Nick Shackle and Chris Kidd and those guys came over during that window of time, they were critical people to the development of the team. But, you know, as Europeans do, they, you know, you guys appreciate being able to go to college and swim at the same time, because over there generally that's hard to do. So we've developed a I'd say somewhat of a formula to have success. And in 2007, I don't remember the championships 2007 being a third or fourth the struggle that just getting our first SEC championship was, you know. And they say it's harder to repeat than to win the first time. You know, I think if you have the right sort of formula, the right mixture, and you give enough autonomy to the assistant coaches and to the staff, the staffing, and do a good job of hiring, it's not as hard actually, and it can be done.
So obviously, you won numerous NCAA titles there, and 12 NCAA titles, and the most successful Auburn coach, irrespective of sport. Those years where, you know, there wasn't a title, how was, you know, cause when you're so used to winning the titles, how was that? How did that feel? Did you use that as extra motivation for the next year?
Well, that's a great question. I don't get asked that question hardly ever, so good, really nice insight in that. Yeah, that's a really interesting challenge, because the athletes that were coming to school by the late 90s and early 2000s, they were coming to win championships. And part of our sell to them was, come to Auburn, help us win a national championship. And do you want to wear this big, you know, I don't have a ring on now, but do you want to wear this big ring the rest of your life? Then you need to come join us, because this is the team that's going to win. And we weren't winning. We were still competing, you know, in the top, you know, two or three usually. So we were right there. There were a couple of years where I would come back and I'd get back in town and I'd go to church, because I go to church on Sundays, but I would go to church on Sunday, and a lot of people would say, oh, I'm sorry, Coach Marsh, you got second in NCAAs. And there were years where we had great meets and we took second place. We just were beat by a better team. And there are some years where if we'd have swam up to our level, we would have won. And those are tougher to take. But I would say one thing was, those years make you reset. So I would say those key years between the late 90s and when we were winning toward the end, the middle of 2000s, were really key years, because it was a chance to sort of figure out the staffing, figure out the team dynamic. And to some degree, I think also in our sport, I was on my, you know, through my time at Auburn, I had five athletic directors. With every athletic director, it was sort of a different philosophy. They would or choir, and to some degree over that time, it had become that, you know, we had a self-contained environment where we did, you know, we sort of had pretty good control over the whole program, to where soon the you know, more and more things are pulled out of our control. We weren't able to control some of the decisions, and I wasn't great at being okay with that. So I had to learn to adjust in those early 2000s to a new athletic department culture, a new culture of athletes who were coming in, because the difference in an early 90s athlete and a 2000s athlete was very different. And you know, you had to walk with them quite a bit more. And that was something I had to learn in that process. And we as a staff did. And so we were able to sort of regain our footing going into it. But there was one kind of cool moment in those years where we hadn't won in 3 years. And one of our summers, Pat Calhoun in particular is his name, he ended up making the Olympic team for the USA. But he literally, the very first, you know, team meeting that we had, he told the team, guys, it is not acceptable that I leave Auburn without a national championship ring. It's like, we are going to win this year. So if you're not ready to do all the things it takes to win, then get the hell out of here. And he's a guy who had already made the Olympic team, that he wanted his Auburn national championship ring. And sure enough, a senior year, the team won the championship again to sort of right that situation. So from, you know, from 97 till 2007, and really Brett Hawk two more years later with Richard Quick, they'd won also. There was a long span where if you went to Auburn, you would leave with a national championship ring. Not quite as long on the women's side, but on the men's side, it was a long span of time.
So you speak there about, obviously, the men's side, the women's side. Through your career, you've coached, you know, males and females, and you've had success, you know, on both sides. For you, what were the key differences between coaching males and coaching females? Is there anything you do differently when you're coaching, you know, for example, Kathleen Baker, to when you're coaching Ryan Lochte?
Yeah, a lot different. Women are much more fun to coach. They're not afraid to work as hard generally. I mean, I think there's a lot of men that work hard, but characterizing it, women can probably handle more overall work. They sort of count on the interaction with the coaches quite a bit more. And I have a couple of students here that swam at University of Michigan, and someone described Rick Bishop and Mike Bottom as one of the things they do really well there. Maggie, that's there, the world champion in the 100 fly, is that, you know, Rick will spend a half an hour talking to the athletes before practice, like several of the key athletes will get a half hour of his time every day. And of course I didn't have that kind of time to give to be able to do that. But I think that's one of the things that can be effective, is a lot, you know, if you communicate a lot more with on the women's side, I think that will reap a lot of benefits, because all athletes want to know that you care about them before they're going to care to dig in for you. I think women is just another level of that. And so I do think that makes a big difference. And it's more, you know, I say it's more fun to coach the women's team in many ways, because the women really invite the coach into the experience. You know, the men, as they win championships, make Olympic teams, it's like, I'm an Olympian. You know, the women, it's like they want to hug their coach, and they want to hug their family, and they want to pull people in with them generally. Now, I'm sure all aren't like that, but that's my experience. And so I think that's part of why I didn't know right away, but it didn't take me long to figure out that I need a strong female associate head coach to be a partner with me, to keep a keen eye on the women's team. And then as a female, I think they can more effectively communicate very directly with them too. You know, there's things that I can't say as a male to a female athlete that a female coach can say. And I think that sometimes was part of the formula for how we developed the program at Auburn. And even to this day, you know, I don't have a female coach on my staff right now, other than, you know, but my wife is quite effective. My wife's an excellent coach, and she'll occasionally have sort of very calm talks with some of the athletes, and it can be very effective for you know, for foundationally managing that relationship. But Kathleen's a different motivation type person. She's just switched on all the time, motivation wise. I actually have to protect her from herself a lot more. At the level where, let's go with professional level, I've gotten to where I understand that I can't really create new motivation for them. I can join their motivation, but I'm not going to create new motivation.
Yeah.
The club team we have in town, so we have 11 to 18 year olds, the environment and the coaching interaction absolutely can create motivation. Absolutely can create motivation that wasn't there before, because a lot of it's based on belief. And so those athletes need to know you believe in them. And the deal is, if you're a coach in our sport, and shame on you if you ever don't believe that somebody can be way better than they are, because swimming is an odd sport. Swimming isn't in a natural environment. We're in water where God did not make us to be swimmers. I mean, he made us to walk on land and run from things and jump on things, not to get in pool and try to move like a fish. So we're learning that all the time. And there's a day where a young person, and you probably had this happen to some of the athletes that you work with, that it's almost like 1 week to a next, or even 1 day to a next, one meet, something happened. It's like, whoa, you're a whole nother level now. And it's just that relation to the water a lot of times is what can make the magic. And so I always tell parents and young coaches, I said, look, let kids play in the water. Figure out ways to gamify the water a little bit more for them, so they're just enjoying the water in all kinds of different settings and environments, not just the top layer of the water. Go down under the water, experience. That's what's so nice about California is we always have good waves out there. So I'm saying, guys, get out there and surf. Get out there and body surf. Get out there and skin dive and do these kind of, figure out ways to enjoy water in lots of ways. And I think that relationship can be built in the aquatic environment.
Interesting. So providing, you know, kids enjoy the water and move through and they progress. When you're a college coach, what is it you're looking for when you're recruiting? Is there certain, you know, mental skills that you need your swimmers to have? Is it a certain physique or training background? What is it you look for when you're recruiting those swimmers?
Well, I get better and better recruiting. But I was always good at recruiting in terms of communication with recruits and things like that, because, you know, I really believed in what I was selling. I was selling Auburn University, a school that I went to that I loved, and it's a school that can be transformative for different kinds of people. You don't have to, you know, may not have the academic profile of a Harvard or a Michigan, but, you know, Tim Cook came from there. We had lots of astronauts come from Auburn, some of the, you know, most cutting edge people. So I could sell that really well. But like I said, I think there needed to be someone that when I met with a high school kid in their living room to do an in-home visit, I would evaluate them. I would see how their interactions were with their parents, how they talked about their current coach. You know, if it was always like, yeah, that guy, he doesn't know what he's doing, eye roll. It's like, that's what they're going to say about me later on. And they're not going to believe in me in that kind of way. And then with the parents, it's like there's not a healthy respect at home, and they're, you know, doing this, doing that. And there were occasions where I had in-home visits and went into the home planning on giving them a certain kind of scholarship offer, you know, because most swimming scholarships, especially on men's side, are partial scholarship offers. I was going to give, let's say, this guy, you know, $25,000 total scholarship. And by the end of the time I walked out the door, I said, well, I'll take a chance at this guy, but only for $5,000 now. So they lost $20,000 by their behavior at home with the way they might have interacted with their parents. And, you know, you just want to say to them, you're great. You're really making a big mistake right now. But so character is certainly part of it. And then eagerness is probably the other biggest one. I mean, when I was recruiting, I wanted people who liked talking swimming a little bit or knew a lot about the way they felt when they swam. It didn't have to be times and intervals and things like that, but it needed to be, you know, that they loved racing and practice. And because ultimately, if they were a great trainer, that was nice, but ultimately we were a racing team, not a training team. There were lots of teams that trained more volume than Auburn back in those days, or lots of teams that probably went on faster intervals. But to prepare for racing is what our skill was at Auburn. And I think that's a different environment than the other. So I was looking for racers that were engaged, that ideally had, you know, strong character, and that would be sort of my ideal recruit.
So when you spoke about, you know, you reduced the percentage scholarship, like they lost $20,000 just from their behavior at home, it just reminded me of, I think it's in the book about Eddie Reese that Chuck Warner wrote. Eddie always says that nice people make good swimmers. And how important is it, like you just said there, it's important that if you're going to coach someone, you've got to know that ultimately they're a nice person as well.
I would say nice people are more nice to have on your team. And you do need to have a core group of nice people. I'd honestly say, I don't agree with that, with Eddie. I would say you want to have a team of nice people, but you also want a few firecrackers. You know, you want a few that sort of cause they stir the pot because of their aggressiveness or their, in the men's side, maybe, you know, you generally have a few alphas, and, you know, since I have a lot of sprinters, they, you know, I would have some alphas around the pool deck. And I think that to me was good because it caused people to be on edge a little bit more. And I liked the team that was that way. It'd be great if they all would hold hands and, you know, hum kumbaya through a season, but a season isn't like that. You know, when you're dealing with 18 to 22 year olds, there's a lot of things going on in their mind and in their world outside of the environment, a lot of pressures from different places, and how they react to those pressures is going to affect your team. So we would rely on, you know, having a few more, you know, I would say disruptive personalities at the time, and we would take chances on them, and sometimes intentional chances on a transfer or something like that that might come in and cause us to be challenged. And my experience coaching professionals is the same. I mean, I don't want an athlete to get on the blocks and feel like it's, you know, we're all besties here on the block. I want them to get where they need to get emotionally to say, no, I'm going to rip this person's throat out in the water, metaphorically, I'm gonna rip their throat out and crush them. The other side of that is, you know, I had Anthony Irvin in the last Olympics, and honestly, before the 50 freestyle, one of the magic moments of his experience, the 50 free, was when he went out and the audience was booing the Russians at the Olympics because of the drugs, and then they were cheering wildly for the, you know, and the Brazilians. He said he just sensed an inner peace that we eight people are here unified together. And he really sensed an element of unity that empowered him to feel the right way at the right exact moment at the right event. And to me, that's sort of what we're seeking for, is to coach people where they are, not expect them to come where we are as coaches. We need to go where they are, and the higher level they are, the more likely I'm going to spend more time helping to fortify that. And sort of join their side of the ledger versus making them come over to me. I think to a certain point, you need to sort of acquire certain things and say, you need to come this far, come over here. But, you know, in coaching, eventually you move toward the athlete sort of leading, and we join their path.
So once you kind of left college swimming alone for a little bit, you moved up to North Carolina and joined up with a Swim Mac there, where you kind of established Team Elite, essentially. Whilst you were there, you ended up winning three consecutive Club Excellence Awards in the USA. How different was it instilling that kind of winning culture of excellence within a club program to it was when it was within a college program? What were the differences there for you?
Well, it's a great question again. I think, and this would be great for a lot of the coaches out there that are coaching club, which I think majority of your audience is. The difference when I went to a club was it was more of a system. We had about 800 swimmers, 700 to 800 swimmers on the team. Now there are much larger teams, and you run the numbers, the teams with 1500 and 2000 swimmers should have crushed us at this kind of metric that USA Swimming had set up. But the key was that two big things, I think. One was when I went in, I said, look, we're going to switch the program from being sort of a training-based program to a technique-based program. And that was just immediate. Like I said, when I'm walking into any pool where any of our athletes are practicing, I don't want to see any young backstrokers cross over on their backstroke. And when they're putting their hand in the water, I don't see any of them do that. I don't want to see any of them in breaststroke be stuck back here, the elbows back into the ribs and be in this position in breaststroke. I don't see that by any. So do teach little quarter pulls and builder strokes off the front of the breaststroke. I don't want to see any young kid when they're swimming freestyle, one lap or in the middle of a 500 freestyle, not running a 6-speed kick, you know, Karen Perkins style. I want a boiling kick the whole time. And fly, I want to see the repetitive hip flow and the hips coming up. I don't want to see any butterfly that's all uphill. So the foundation was that we started with sort of technique, then we built sort of guidelines and structure around that, that at different levels, this is the minimum of what you taught. And then if you're a coach coaching this group, you could use your own flavor to teach it, but you at least needed to stay within these parameters in order to develop the athlete at the right time. And then when I came in, I came in with a center of excellence from USA Swimming and the US Olympic Committee to bring professional swimmers to the SWIMAC program, put it on top. So the other one that model I used was comes straight, really in essence, straight from the talent code. Daniel Coyle wrote a great book. And if you're a young coach or any coach or a parent, the talent code is an amazing read, a real important read, I think. And at the end of the day, what it looked like was we were trying to create highly engaged training environment. So we wanted the athletes to be stimulated when they were doing a practice. We wanted, I served as a master coach at the time. We had Kathy McKee, and she was a master coach. We had a few other coaches that I would consider were more like master coaches there. They helped sort of set the vision of what young people could do in our program. And then the deal was, you know, how much we gave them a training load and when we gave them sort of extra training. But there was one moment, I think we were really rocking and rolling, where we created a 13, 14, 15-year-old group that Alan Pfau would coach and I would help out. It was in the middle of town. People would drive to the middle of town to a historically black college. It was a 25-yard dungeon pool, really, but it was water and it was in a good location. It's where more people could get to it, but we'd have our best 13, 14, 15-year-olds get together, and we called it the Turbo Group. And 3 days a week, they would get together and they would go at it. They would train really hard, not just the training, but they'd also watch the team elite athletes who would have just gotten out of the water right before them. And this is really where, you know, Kathleen Baker and several world-class swimmers came out of that young group that would sit aside and watch the team elite athletes. And then when the team elite athletes would get out, you know, they would get in and train. So it was sort of following the model of Swiss or Norwegian skiing, but there was some examples out there of younger kids regularly seeing world-class athletes, and their vision was set to where they would have this this engagement that they wouldn't go without not accomplishing that. So I think we had a lot of that going on within our program, and I think the challenge for the club team was to develop that with a atmosphere that that fed upwards. Eventually we decided that getting athletes to good colleges and having them swim in college is one of our foundational beliefs, having an eye on high performance. So we always wanted to be pointing upward. But yet if somebody wasn't looking at that, there were still places in our program you could go, but you might not be in the group with the group going this way. You might have to be in a different training group. So we sort of do some separation like that. And then finally that initial engagement. So our 10, 9, 10, 11-year-olds, like the coaches we were trying to hire were just fun people that made the kids love the sport. And that's what we try to do, is make sure when they first coming into our program and transitioning from our preteen program that they just learn to love the sport. So those are things that I think everybody can use, and I think they still work to this day. You know, even though SWIMAC's gone a different way, they've gotten rid of the team elite sort of high performance stuff and are doing more of a sort of a club, you know, sort of a big club program now. They're still having some good success, but it's just different. And the way I would say, if you're in a town where, you know, if, for example, if you're anywhere near Loughborough, you could go sit in the bleachers and watch the athletes work out there, or you can go into Bath and watch the athletes work out there. Just sit in the bleachers, you know, once a month, and just observe what's going on when these elite athletes are training. Because what you also notice is they're human beings, and they fail sometimes. They act quirky sometimes. And I think the humanism of that can really help a young person to go, oh, I can do this too. You know, I'm the same as them.
I think what you said there about, you set up that kind of that turbo group that would train after the team elite group, but they'd get there earlier, that they'd watch. It's so important that if you want to inspire those kids to go on to then become excellent, potentially world-class swimmers, that they can see those kind of behaviors being modeled in front of their eyes, like you say there.
That's why when we set up lanes, like we would have the lanes be, you know, the most motivated kids would be next to the group that's the next age up most motivated. So they would be around those kind of people. Then we'd encourage the coaches to have them train together sometimes and do some big brother, big sister stuff where they interacted. And so those kind of moments really can make a difference, because, you know, a 12-year-old looking at Adam Peaty will get a lot of excitement and inspiration out of it, but they're probably going to get actually more actual I can do this mentality by a 14-year-old in a team that's good at something they're good at, connecting with them and carrying it forward.
You've worked with some really world-class swimmers, over nearly 50 Olympians. You know, Ryan Lochte, Kathleen Baker, Cullen Jones, you know, the list kind of goes on. In your opinion, what separates the really kind of world-class swimmers from the rest? And who have you enjoyed coaching the most within that?
Well, I enjoy Kathleen a lot, because I've been coaching her since she's 14, and she hasn't lost any of her eagerness to be willing to learn. And it's funny, because early on in her career, we agreed that the IM would be the key event for her career, and off of that she was in a lot of other events, and it's begun to be full circle where even though she went up the world record in the backstroke, and her backstrokes are still very fast, she swam really fast in Des Moines right before this incident, she's come back to the IM, is still her favorite event, and probably was on a good pathway to get a medal in that event at the Olympics had we had it this year. Now, all along, she's always had Crohn's disease, so she can only handle so much training load, so we have to be real careful with the load we give her. I would say the characteristic of a big picture, because I've had, honestly, you know, what if you watch some of the athletes I've had, you'd say, well, they're not very motivated. How'd they ever get to be an Olympic medalist? Because they don't look like they want to be here. Well, they may act like that on the outside, but inside, there'd always be a moment in time where they'd switch on. You know, Cullen Jones would switch on when it was time to get serious. He's like a boxer. He needed to go into sort of training camp mode, and then he would go all in. Or some people would need to experience a failure, and then they respond, hey, that's not like me, and they would go back in. So they had to have sort of an inner drive. They've all have an inner drive that's been developed over time. Some of it maybe a little bit genetic, but a lot of it has been because of environments they've been in. There isn't one, and this is for the coaches out there, there isn't one of the Olympic athletes that I've coached that can't put their finger on the memory of having a key coach some point in time do something that fortified them and ignited them at a whole nother level. And they carried it with them the whole time. They remember that moment when that coach believed in me, or the coach held me accountable when I was being lazy and they made me stay after practice and do it 3 times again, 10 times again, and held me accountable at that level. Didn't like them back then, but now I know why I did that. So I think that's the thing that the best of the best they get that inner drive in there, and it comes out all kinds of different ways. And I know when you have somebody going really good when they're training, you know, with full intensity, and I have to go in and protect them. No, now you're going, I got to pull you out. You take 2 or 3 days off or adjust to this and this. And fortunately, I have some swimmers now that sort of operate like that. And I got to keep a keen eye on them so they don't go over the edge. And so we're obviously during quarantine, we haven't had that problem, but as we get back to the pool, we'll have to pay more attention to that.
Yeah. So you mentioned there about Cullen Jones and you alluded to it earlier in the podcast that you tend to have worked with quite a few sprinters in your time as well.
Yeah.
Like Fred Brisquet, Cullen Jones, Rowdy Gaines. In your opinion, when can you tell that an athlete is a sprinter compared to other athletes, and what really sets apart the training that they need to do from your normal middle distance kind of athletes?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. First of all, I was coaching NCAA at the time. Before that, when I was a club coach, it was, Melvin Stewart broke the world record in the 200 butterfly during that window of time. But in the NCAA program, the sprinters counted a lot. they were one of some of the best ways you can win championships is to have great sprinters. Also, it fits sort of my philosophy, which is recovery first. So when I'm designing a season plan or a weekly plan, I'll put in the recovery sessions or recovery, usually it's Wednesday, sometimes it's Tuesday morning, Thursday afternoon, but I'll build that in and I'll build the training around that, because I don't want athletes to ever get to where they go so far over the edge that they start detraining or overtraining. And I'm sure I've had many athletes overtrain in my window of time, but sprinters especially, most of my years at Auburn and many times now when I've designed seasons or even, sort of mesocycles, for sprinters, I'll take Wednesday and they'll do a complete dry day Wednesday. Then we'll get in the water at all. So they'll have Sunday off, Wednesday off. That's the foundation. And in many cases, some of my sprinters right now, they only train once per day in the water. But now gym is as intense, if not more intense in some cases, than the water. So they are training really hard. It's just not always at the pool. So what makes a sprinter, certainly there's some element of genetics, but I would tell you that Anthony Irvin is not doesn't jump very high off the ground. I would say Caleb, I wouldn't say he could double Anthony's vertical jump, but I would say pretty close. Anthony's game was he was incredibly efficient. His club coach, Bruce, out in Santa Clarita, did an amazing job teaching him amazing technique at a young age. And he was, very natural in that way. And he was very narrow, so he used that to his benefit. He cut the water like a barracuda. Whereas, a guy like Cullen Jones was a lot of power. He had to have power. Cesar Cielo was very different. He could actually swim. He first came in to meet Auburn. I was having him swim the 200 freestyles and do some training with 500s and workouts. Beautiful, elegant swimmer. And then as he put on strength, all of a sudden his speed just blew up, Pernell Bloomwick had come in and trained with me during his lap before 2016. And in that window of time, I didn't think like she was had any shot at winning the Olympic gold medal. I thought she would, she was good, but I had Ariana Vanderpool Wallace and Madison Kennedy, who I thought were actually better. They were beating her in practice. When we climb ropes, they'd be stronger than her. But Pernell had a racing mentality that she could bring all of this stuff she would do. She'd bring it to the race in a beautiful way. And she's a very interesting story in terms of the way she won that gold in 2016, but it had a whole lot to do with her tenacity of racing. And sprinters at a high level need to be racers.
Absolutely. So you yourself, as a swimmer, you were an All-American backstroke swimmer in your time at Auburn when you were swimming. How did you transfer your experience, being such a good swimmer into coaching? Was there anything that transferred across with you?
I think just my love of swimming, because I didn't start swimming until I was 15 years old. I was a baseball player. And then when I got cut from the baseball team, I went to swimming. So during my whole career, I improved every year. One year I had a little bit of a plateau, but I just love swimming. And then as soon as I love competing. I didn't love training. I love competing. As soon as I transferred to coaching, I love coaching more than I like swimming. So it was a pretty easy transfer. And I always tried to build that love of the sport into the athletes that I've coached.
Who's been your biggest influences on you as a coach and a person? So who's been that kind of coach and inspiration for you?
Richard Quick is his name. He was my coach at Auburn, and he was the Olympic coach many, many times for the USA. I was so blessed, so fortunate to be at Auburn when he was there, because basically, so when I transitioned to coaching, I just more or less put my finger in his belt loop and I went where he went. So when he'd go to coaches' conventions, I'd go with him. He'd introduce me to, you know, Doc Councilman and these other great coaches, and I would just sit at tables and listen to these people talk. And he was just such a respected human being, much less a coach. I've really adopted his style, and to some degree, that's great. There's some things about a style that probably wasn't ideal. And you know, I'm still such a creative that I'll go to practice and really create the practice at practice, which I don't recommend for young coaches. I say go in with an exact plan for what you're going to do and adjust it. But you know, I learned from him. So yeah, Richard Crook clearly was, and he's passed on now. And so it's really sad because he never wrote a book. He never did a podcast like this, honestly. So we don't really have a record of his mind, how he thought. And so I hope that in talking to you today, you are hearing a lot of Richard Quick. So I'm passing that on, and he's certainly been my guy.
Awesome. So just to finish up, we always ask coaches to give their kind of top three tips on a certain topic. What would your kind of top three tips be for developing a winning, excellent culture within a program?
Yeah, I think I've sort of covered that a little bit, in that it's having a vision and your passion behind the vision is more important. To me, when you're looking at it, it's the ambition and passion behind the mission. You can have a mission all you want. You write on a piece of paper, you can put it on a sticky thing and put it in front of your face every day. If there's not a driver behind that, that may happen because you're reminded of it. But if you want it to really happen, it will happen if you have the drive to make it happen. Sometimes that means you need to do more, you need to work harder, you need to be ever more present. Sometimes it means you need to step back and let somebody else do something that can affect you getting that way, or that athlete getting that way. So I'd say the first thing is that sort of mission and vision. Second thing I would say is having a lifelong learning attitude and the humility to know that you don't know what you think you know. If you'd have told me a while back that athletes would be racing at 0.9 tempo in breaststroke like Adam Peaty does, I would have said you're nuts. And I've always loved breaststroke the most. I would say as a coach, breaststroke's the most interesting stroke to coach. Well, you know, Melanie obviously thought of something. He and Melanie thought of something way before a lot of us, to take that guy and have him race at that kind of tempo. You know, he's changed a lot of the outlook. And so you have to have an open mind in our sport. We haven't swum as fast as we can swim. And then the final thing is, I think you have to enjoy the process. And I think as a coaches, we need to create environments that are enjoyable. And as athletes, even though we can be a really boring sport going up down the same lane, we need to understand that we're the opportunity for joy in the team environment, in the coach-athlete environment, in the life lessons you learn through our sport are transformative and can be transformative to help people be truly successful in life and have rich, deep relationships with males and females that they train with and people that they're around at meets and they encounter. So those are the three big ones to me.
Excellent. David Marsh, thank you very much for your time. And enjoyed this conversation as much as any conversation I've ever had, I imagine. So thank you very much for that.
Appreciate that. Yeah, all the best to you, and good luck with your coaching too. I hope you do. I look forward to following you in the future and watching how you're doing. It sounds like you're on a great track.
Excellent. Thank you. So that wraps series one up. Over the course of these 20 episodes, we've spoken to some of the best coaches in the country and, of course, over the world, including this episode here with David Marsh. We're back in September with series two. We'll be talking nutrition, psychology, S&C, talent development pathways. But also, we'll still be talking to some of the best coaches around and bringing you stories from coaches' careers. Until then, keep learning and take care. Goodbye.